Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. New York Governor Kathy Hochul signed a law this week expanding legal protections for family members of domestic violence survivors. The Legislative Gazette's Jesse King reports.
Bill is signed. Woo!
Melanie's Law closes a loophole in state law that previously prevented adult family and household members from obtaining their own orders of protection against a loved one's abusive partner. Before signing the law at the Family Partnership Center in Poughkeepsie, a Democrat said the subject of domestic violence is personal to her. Hochul's mother advocated for survivors throughout her life.
And I'm going to continue being this fighter, not just because of what I saw and the stories I had to hear, but for all those I feel responsible to protect, because my number one job as governor of the state of New York is to protect our citizens.
Melanie's Law is named after Melanie Chianese, a Wappingers Falls woman who was stabbed to death by her mother's ex-boyfriend, Paul Senecal, in 2022. Chianese and her son both lived with her mother, Cheryl Chianese Cavalli. Cheryl was able to obtain an order of protection against her ex, and that restraining order extended to Melanie's son, but not Melanie, because she was an adult. The new law allows all family and household members to obtain orders of protection in these cases, regardless of their age. Chianese Cavalli says her daughter would have turned 32 on Sunday.
Melanie loved to help others. That was her dream in life and her goal. She wanted to be a certified drug and alcohol counselor. And if given the chance, she would have been a great one, right? And now today, she will forever be known as Melanie's Law. Thank you. God bless everyone.
In the years since Melanie's death, Chianese Cavalli has steadily advocated for Melanie's Law. It was first sponsored by Republican Dutchess County Executive Sue Serino back when she was state senator for the 41st District. It was then picked up by State Senator Michelle Hinchey and 43rd District Assemblyman Brian Cunningham, both Democrats. The bill passed unanimously in the state Senate and cleared the Assembly earlier this year. Hinchey says she considers working on Melanie's Law to be a standout moment of her career.
Understanding the scale of this problem and this challenge, and something that we had the power to change by closing a loophole, we have a power to make sure that other people don't have to be sitting in this position, and they'll know for decades to come that this family and that we collectively in this community were able to stand together to make a huge change.
Family Services, which operates the Family Partnership Center, offers counseling and case management to survivors of domestic abuse. CEO Leah Feldman says it's common for abusers to target a survivor's loved ones once they lose access to the survivor themselves, and it's a big reason why survivors refuse to leave or report the abuse. She looks forward to helping family members as they, too, seek restraining orders in court, and she has a couple ideas about what the state could do next to support survivors.
It's a long process to get an order of protection through the family court system, which can also be a deterrent to individuals utilizing that system. So finding a way to speed that process up could be useful.
Feldman says it's important to watch out for signs of domestic abuse early on in relationships. She says abusers often start by isolating their partners, controlling their finances, and manipulating their emotions.
One of the myths is that is the black eyes, right? That oftentimes domestic violence is not physical until the very end, and sometimes until it's too late. So we like to advise people to look for those other red flags.
Paul Senecal was convicted of first-degree murder for the killing of Melanie Chianese and sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole in 2023. Family Services has a 24/7 hotline for survivors of domestic violence at 845-485-5550. The New York State Office for the Prevention of Domestic Violence also has a hotline at 1-800-942-6906. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Jesse King.
Cows and other livestock are responsible for 30% of human-caused methane emissions. When cows burp, they emit methane, one of the most potent greenhouse gases that fuels climate change. As WSKG's Rebecca Rettelmeyer reports, researchers in New York are studying how to reduce those emissions by changing what farmers feed their animals.
In a building on the edge of Cornell University's campus in Ithaca, animals are under observation. There are sheep in stalls along a wall, and in the middle of the room, there are two large cows. They stand inside what looks like a giant metal box with windows that allow animal science professor Joseph McFadden to watch them. He begins to explain the metal box, called a respiration chamber.
What it does is allows us to fully quantify gas exchange.
But he's interrupted.
So that's methane, carbon dioxide, oxygen, hydrogen.
Essentially, the chamber measures the exact amount of gas a cow emits. And that's important because scientists know cows burp out methane as they digest food. Cornell's respiration chamber is the first facility in the United States that can record comprehensive data on exactly how much gas is in those burps. Other technology can only estimate it. McFadden says it comes at a pretty significant time for the dairy industry that's under pressure to reduce its methane emissions.
It's a frenzy. I've been doing animal science now for several decades, and there's never been a time like this.
Amid the frenzy, the respiration chamber will help scientists study how something the dairy industry is betting big on could actually work. The bet is on feed additives, basically the idea that feeding cows something new could make their burps contain less methane. Cows make methane mostly because of an enzyme in their stomachs. Studies so far show that certain additives, ranging from natural stuff like seaweed to engineered powders, can suppress that enzyme, at least for a short period. The FDA has already approved one powder additive for widespread use. That's promising, says Eric Tonesmeyer, a fellow at the environmental think tank Project Drawdown.
It's great that some portions of the industry are actually accepting that methane is the real thing and trying to make a plan to do something about that.
He's interested in where the research will go, but he says there are already major limitations. One is that additives will cost farmers time and money, which will limit how many end up using them.
I would say that at the global level, this is going to be a very, very small piece of the puzzle.
And Tonesmeyer doesn't want the dairy industry to use additives as an excuse.
The biggest concern, honestly, is that the beef and dairy industry might use this to say, oh, don't worry about us. We're covering our emissions, no problem.
He says the best way to reduce emissions from cows is to reduce the amount of meat we eat. Dairy farmer Keith Kimball raises cattle in Groveland, New York, and chairs the Northeast Dairy Producers Association. He has hope that additives will help farmers reduce their emissions, but he's wary too.
This is something that farmers will for sure consider, but is going to make us more efficient as an industry and improve our carbon footprint. I'm not positive that it is.
It's hard work to raise cows, full of careful calculations to make sure cows are healthy and producing lots of milk. Kimball is concerned that feed additives could mess up that equation and make his cows less productive. That's what he hopes research can figure out.
I am excited to see where it goes. If it's positive and you can reduce the methane emissions at the same time, making sure the cows are still healthy and that it doesn't have a negative effect on the cows.
Kimball says he's standing by to see whether research will show if feed additives are worth it, if they can reduce emissions long term without harming cows. It's one of the major questions the Animal Respiration Chamber at Cornell University could help answer. In Ithaca, I'm Rebecca Rettelmeyer for the New York Public News Network.
Listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Giustina. This week, I sat down with WNYC's Capitol Bureau Chief, John Campbell, and we spoke about newly signed legislation. I started by asking John about Melanie's Law.
Yeah, and that is a law that the governor signed about domestic violence, and it closes a loophole in the restraining order process, and that's one, you know, it goes to one of the governor's themes of her administration and her time in office is standing up for what she sees as standing up for domestic violence victims and public safety in general. So it generally goes to that theme. The governor, during her first first election bid because she was elevated to the role when Andrew Cuomo resigned in 2021. But during her election in 2022, she struggled very much with the issue of public safety. Lee Zeldin, the Republican, made it his number one campaign priority to paint Kathy Hochul as soft on crime, and it worked. I mean, she only won by 5.5 points in a very, very blue state. I mean, that was a very small margin of victory.
And John, it worked with crime statistics going down.
Well, and, you know, there's always different ways you can cut the crime statistics, and you can look at it from year to year, or you can look at it from now to 10 years ago or 20 years ago. And generally, there's a steep drop when you look at the long-term trends of crime. But, you know, politicians like to twist those numbers any way they can that benefits them. But that said, since her election in 2022, her tight election in 2022, Governor Hochul has taken steps to kind of bolster her image as tougher on crime. You know, often the Democratic Party gets painted as soft on crime. She's tried to bolster that image as tough on crime, and this is, you know, one more step there. She often has press conferences and bill signings about public safety issues, and this is yet another one.
Well, the lawmakers went to the, I don't know what you would call it, the attic or the deep basement, pulled this dusty old bill off the shelf that said it's illegal to cheat on your wife or your husband or your partner, your married partner. And finally, they've legalized adultery. Hooray, New York. It's a
weird one. It is a weird one. What's weirder yet is New York was one of 17 states that had an adultery law still on the books. I mean, New York's law said if you're married, you have intercourse with somebody who's not your spouse, your living spouse, it specifies, then you've committed adultery, and that's a Class B misdemeanor punishable by up to 90 days in jail. So it was on the books for more than 100 years. It was 117 years, actually, that it was on the books. But it was rarely enforced. There was really only about a dozen times or so since the 70s where it has been enforced. But it was enforced as recently as 2010. There was a case out in Batavia in Western New York between Buffalo and Rochester where a woman was charged with adultery that was later dropped. But, you know, it wasn't maybe as far off as we make it seem to be. I mean, that was only 14 years ago. So the governor signed a bill into law last week that repeals New York's adultery law, so now it is no longer a crime to commit adultery, although, you know, some religions would say it's a sin, but it is no longer a crime punishable by potential jail time. And that said, the governor, when she signed it, she issued a statement saying, well, this is maybe a little ironic because I've been married for 40 years, but I don't think this is, she called it a silly law, quote unquote silly law, and she signed a bill repealing it.
That's John Campbell, Capitol reporter for WNYC and The Gothamist. Listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Joining us on this week's Legislative Gazette is Vanella Yadhati, Vice President of Renewable Project Development for the New York Power Authority, that is NYPA, and as part of the 2023-24 enacted state budget in New York, NYPA is tasked with leading the drafting of a 2025 strategic plan to identify actions they can take, as well as priorities for building more renewable resources and support decarbonizing New York State's electric grid. And we welcome Vanella Yadhati to the Legislative Gazette.
Hi, David. Thank you for having me.
And just to get the listeners on the inside of our discussion, you've been going around the state holding hearings. You were in Long Island as we speak on a Tuesday morning before Thanksgiving, late into the evening last night. I believe there are 11 or 12 so far that you've done.
Why don't we talk about not only these hearings and what you're finding out, but maybe start with what the law is, what your group is tasked to do as a reminder, and then why you're reaching out to the public.
Absolutely. As part of the 2023-24 enacted state budget, NYPA received new expanded authority for, I will call it, yet another opportunity to further serve New Yorkers in the clean energy space. The expanded authority allows NYPA to develop, build, finance, own, and operate a combination of those verbs, renewable generation projects, such as solar, wind, and battery energy storage system, to help the state achieve its bold renewable energy objectives outlined in the Climate Act. So that's, in short, what the expanded authority received is. As part of the enacted budget, the legislation also requires NYPA to be holding at least 3 public hearings across the state to gather feedback on the draft strategic plan we've published. We published the draft strategic plan on October 8th, and that's kind of like the roadshow in a way that you've just mentioned over the past few weeks that we've been doing. While the legislation required us to hold only 3, we wanted to hear from as many New Yorkers as possible. So we've held 12 sessions total from across the state, all the way beginning in Buffalo to Binghamton to Albany. We held virtual sessions for those who may not appear in person or who cannot, and in New York City, along with 2 sessions yesterday, the last ones that we had, sessions 11 and 12 on Long Island.
And what are you hearing?
That's the beautiful part of it, right? Because we heard opinions and inputs to, I will even say, emotions from that range across the entire spectrum, including concerns about New York State possibly falling short and may not be able to meet its goals within the set time frame, and requesting NYPA to do more, to acknowledging what we've done to date, which is, again, reassuring, to also requesting NYPA to be pivoting and looking at the long-term opportunities as well beyond intermittent resources and looking at what other technologies there may be available and how do we focus on those to ensure reliability and resiliency and other needs of the state as well. There were thoughts about how exactly should we go about citing these projects, where exactly should we be citing to, including actually receiving some specific project leads from the public too, which was actually very, very helpful.
Well, one of the aspects of the strategic renewable plan is using union labor, right?
That's absolutely correct.
Well, talk about that. I mean, not everybody's keen, you know, on unions. And obviously you want, I'm guessing, the folks who are working on this, you want them to get paid fairly. And that's, I'm guessing, why you want it to be union supported.
Absolutely. There are 2 things here. And I'll go back to NYPA being very deliberate in our approach. And that is actually witnessed if you read through our draft strategic plan. There are 2 elements here. As part of the expanded authority, NYPA also made a commitment to invest up to $25 million annually in collaboration with the New York State Department of Labor to create jobs and provide workforce training for people, those that especially want to work in the clean energy industry. Our goal is not just to create clean energy jobs, David, but actually turn them into good-paying clean energy careers. So that's the perspective and the approach we're taking. And that is imperative to ensure that we utilize skilled labor on these projects that will provide consistent, sustainable jobs. Not, when I say sustainable, you know, the workplace, not just those that are in the clean energy space, but actually those jobs are sustainable in the long term. So every project that we are looking at in our proposed pipeline, NYPA will require each and every renewable project to be built with union labor. And all the work that we're doing associated with the project, that we will require the contractors and subcontractors to utilize apprenticeship agreements. So the idea is, again, those that are learning on this, our first tranche of projects we've identified in our first strategy plan, can be seasoned veterans for NYPA's future renewable plans and projects.
We're speaking with Vanella Yadhati, Vice President of Renewable Project Development for the New York Power Authority. Yeah, Vanella, I really want to have hope that the folks in the state legislature support this kind of movement toward renewables. Although when I talk to folks, many on the Republican side in the minority of the Assembly or the Senate, they often say it's too expensive. You can't require people to do this. How are we going to survive? They complain
that, you know, New York's only responsible for a small percentage of the emissions in the world. Why would we be doing so much? But don't we have a huge role to play here?
We absolutely do. And I think it extends beyond why should I be doing. In a way, everybody recognizes the concerns, everything that you've mentioned earlier, from wildfires to storms that we're seeing more often than not, to climate change is real and climate change is here, right? So we need to address it, lest the lack of not addressing it is going to be even more expensive. I think that is recognized as well. The other thing I will also say, when it comes to especially renewable energy projects, even looking at from the federal perspective and the nationwide perspective, most of the there is greater deployment in so-called, I would say, red states than blue states historically as well. Like Texas, the Wind Belt is the entire Midwest kind of project. The projects are built in those states mostly, right? So there is a benefit, and that's why I would also think that the bill that got passed was bipartisan. So I think that sentiment is shared across everybody, especially by all New Yorkers. Inaction possibly leading to greater expense than doing something about it. And also, I'm an electrical engineer by training, so speaking from the technical perspective, you do want, this is about grid resiliency, this is about energy democracy, this is as much about energy democracy as it is about energy independence and national security in a way, because it's critical to have a diverse mix of resources that inject into our grid and that are connected to our grid. Only then can we truly say, yes, we are energy independent and we can achieve the resiliency that we need and the reliability we need as New Yorkers and keep our lights on. I think that's the goal and the aim. Keeping aside the political aspects, speaking from the technical perspective, that's the engineer's take from my side.
Yeah, sure. Well, and it makes so much sense to be diversified on any level in your life, but certainly when it comes to energy and keeping the lights on. The question I have for you, and it's sort of lurking on the outside of all of this renewable talk and, retrofitting our buildings and our plants and trying to reduce the emissions, is these continued calls for nuclear power. Does that fit in anywhere here? Is that totally separate? We have arguments on either side, but certainly one of the major ones is scientists say, well, you can't just do it with wind or solar. You're going to need something else.
Great question, David. While the expanded authority we received last year through this enacted state budget is about renewable generation, and according to New York State definition, even legal definition under the Clean Energy Standard, there are only certain technologies that would qualify for renewable generation. And this strategic plan is about such technologies. We are taking a technology agnostic approach. That's where, even if you look at our initial launch of these 40 projects, we have solar, land-based wind, and battery energy storage systems in there. But earlier this year, NYPA had issued a request for qualifications to the private sector. And it is evident, even if you look at that, that we took a technology agnostic approach within, again, the confines of the definition of renewable energy in New York State. But I will say this too. New York State in the CLCPA has two goals when it comes to clean energy. Like, one is 70% renewable electricity by 2030. The other one is 100% zero emissions electricity by 2040. And I think the state was very, again, I'll use my favorite word, I think, on the show is deliberate. I think the state was intentional and deliberate in setting those two as separately and clearly defining the difference and the nuances there of renewable electricity versus zero emissions electricity. Because going back to that, you would need a diverse source of mix of resources, and that could include any and all of the newer existing technologies to future newer up-and-coming advanced technologies, including nuclear, I would say.
Yeah, and how much innovation are we seeing here? You know, one of the areas of storage, you know, we learned about battery storage and how much can you do, and, you know, even computer memory, and it just able to do more and more and more. So are we seeing any innovation when it comes to power storage?
Absolutely, because what is mostly deployed and most commercially viable today is the lithium-ion battery energy storage systems, which is, in a way, short-term, short-duration battery energy storage systems as they're defined, right? But there are so many advancements happening in the long-duration energy storage, seasonal storage, including you've heard about hydrogen being potential for that. There is potential for hydrogen and something like that there, to advanced compressed air energy storage systems, to ion air batteries. That innovation hasn't stopped. It continues to pick and gain momentum. While on the renewable generation side with solar and wind, you're seeing more and more efficient panels or more efficient turbines. On the energy storage side, you're seeing the spectrum of newer and newer technologies advancing on, I'll call it again, going back to the duration requirements. If you look at even how California had recently issued RFPs, they've done it for two things. One is about a four-hour duration, the other one is about 10 to 12-hour duration, then they're talking about multi-day, then you're talking about the seasonal storage as well. So those are all, again, needed. We will need not necessarily backup, but firm capacity needs through energy storage systems, including in New York State. There is a lot of advancement beyond research. We are in the, I would say, beyond demonstration and technologies deployed, even for the longer than the short duration energy storage technologies.
We've been speaking with Vanella Yadhadi, Vice President of Renewable Project Development for the New York Power Authority. What a task you have before you. I can only wish you all the luck in the world, Vanella, in your efforts. And I can't thank you enough for taking some time to speak to New Yorkers about the importance of renewable energy.
Thank you so much, David. It is a complete privilege, actually, to be able to do this and continue to support New York on its really, really nation-leading and aggressive climate goals.
And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Look for program number 2448 and join us again next week at this same time. For more news on New York State government and politics, for the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Giustina. Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.